Okay, thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Esteban Martinez, bar number 3091. I'm here for Mr. Jamie Prince, the defendant appellant, and I would like to reserve five minutes. And also, I'm going to focus on whether Jamie's waiver was knowing and intelligent, and whether his subsequent confession was voluntary. And also, if I have time, and I don't think I will, but if I do, on the Crawford issue that I raised in the opening brief. First, whether Jamie's waiver was knowing and intelligent. As a preliminary matter, the validity of a Miranda waiver turns on two things, voluntariness and whether it was knowing and intelligent. Also, a waiver can be voluntary but still not valid if it's not knowing and intelligent. And in determining whether a waiver was knowing and intelligent, this court looks to the totality of the circumstances. And here, the totality of the circumstances clearly show that Jamie's waiver was not knowing and intelligent. One, Jamie was and is mentally retarded. At the time of his interrogation, he had a full-scale IQ of 66, and the record shows that at some points during his educational career, as up to the eighth grade, he had an IQ of as low as 54. In addition, he was a juvenile. He was 17 years old. He had a reading comprehension and word recognition skill of that of a early first grader. Also, even though his mother was present at the advisement, she didn't have his best interest in mind as required under 19.2511. And in fact,
Mr. Martinez, let me stop you right there. Let's assume we have, as you say here, a mentally retarded 17-year-old with an IQ of, I forget what you said, 67.
66.
66 and a reading level of 1.4. Just those facts. Does that per se render any waiver of his Miranda rights involuntary or unintelligent?
Not per se, Your Honor. It's the totality of the circumstances.
So we have to, don't we have to look at the background of this young man as well as what was going on at the time? And this was, he was a pretty streetwise guy from what I read in the record. He's been through the criminal system. Can we take that into account? He's been through the criminal system before.
I do not agree that that was replete in the record that he was savvy and was had a large criminal background. He had some outstanding warrants, and he had a guardian ad litem appointed to him. It's unclear why. That record's not made, in, as far as I could tell.
If he does have criminal background, we can take that into consideration in the totality of circumstance, if he's been through this before.
Sure. I mean, and the reason he might have that criminal background might have to do with the fact that he's mentally retarded. So, anyway, even though his mother was present at this advisement, Jamie had a GAL appointed to him, and that indicates strongly, although it's not clear in the record, that she was the subject with respect to Jamie to a D&M proceeding against her. Also, her interests were so adverse to Jamie that she was the person who called the police on Jamie about his outstanding warrants, and those are the warrants that led to his involvement in this particular homicide, because he then wanted to make a deal with the police on these warrants and said he had information on a homicide. And indicative of how adverse she was to Jamie's interest was when the police did arrest him on his outstanding warrants, she stated to the police, even if it would cost me a dollar or something to this effect, I would not want to pay it.
Are those the only two factors that you rely upon to show that the mother's interests were adverse to the defendant's interests?
There are other factors in terms of the way that she behaved at the advisement and during the interrogation. So
what did she do?
The only factors, excuse me?
What did she do during the interrogation that was adverse?
You have to infer this, but when she comes in, at one point she's just talking on her cell phone. She just seems completely disinterested in what's going on with her son. When she sits down, she sits away from her son, and she sits next to the officer.
Sitting sort of between them? Like they're each on one side and she's in the middle?
Somewhat, but the way I saw it, she was sitting closest to the officer. And you could say, I mean, we could disagree about where she sat or who she was closest to, but...
What else?
Go ahead.
What else?
Oh, During the, this is after, during the interrogation, not during the advisement. When Jamie is looking at her, looking for some kind of support, she ignores him. She never responds to him. And again, this is unspoken communication. He's staring at her like, "Mom, you know, somebody help me." And she is just, does, seems to want nothing to do with him. And at the towards the end of the interrogation, at some point, she gets up and she has a phone call or something, and she's running out and says, "I have to go pick up one of my grandbabies." I mean, I don't think that evinces a caring mother who is concerned about the, you know, who has interests aligned with her son.
Before the interrogation began, doesn't she tell him he doesn't have an obligation to speak if he doesn't want to? Doesn't she reiterate his rights, essentially, to him?
I don't recall it, but I'll take your word for it. Okay. Another, this is again back to the advisement. Another thing that occurs is the way that Kreider, the detective who interrogated Jamie, the way that he does it, he de-emphasizes the importance of the Miranda advisement. He refers to the advisement as mere sheets and paperwork, and he races through the reading of that advisement. He does it in under 12 seconds. And today, it's not an effort to ensure that Jamie sufficiently understands the rights that he's being advised of or the consequences of abandoning them. It's more like the officer is trying to, and maybe the officer believes this, but just get through this paperwork because he wants a confession.
Then the case law that says that that type of a reading where they read through the rights in a certain period of time is unconstitutional.
Not that it's per se unconstitutional, but it's a factor that's considered in many of the cases that I cited in the opening brief.
Because when he's done, doesn't he also tell them he's going to leave them alone and let them talk about what he just read to them? And then he comes back and they say, yeah, they both say that they understand their rights, the rights.
Yeah, but before he leaves, what happens is he asks them, "Do you understand what I just read to you?" And Jamie never responds. The mom says yes, and then he does leave. He stops the interrogation. He comes back about 5 minutes later. He does shuffle some papers around, and then he looks at Jamie and says, "Do you understand this?" And the response from Jamie isn't an immediate "Yes, I understand." He's not communicating to the officer the way that I'm trying to communicate with you, with eye contact and so forth. Jamie does this. He stares at the table. It's like 5 seconds, and then he never looks at the officer. He just says, "Yeah." And it's not even a "yeah" with emphasis. It's more like, if you listen to the DVD, it's like, "Yeah." It's not indicative of somebody who understands anything. Anyway, in short, Jamie's his lack of intelligence, his low intelligence, his low language comprehension, the presence of his estranged mother at the advisement, and the way that Kreider de-emphasized the importance of the Miranda rights and seemed to just want to rush through them, and then the way that Jamie seemed to communicate or didn't communicate, in my opinion, that he understood those rights. He was non-responsive and flat, delayed. And then even the amount of time that passed from the time that Kreider had initially read the advisement to Jamie, from the time that Jamie said that he understood them, that was about 7 minutes. All those things go to show that Jamie didn't understand what he was advised of or the consequences of abandoning his rights. And in fact, during the suppression hearing on this, when Jamie called, or Jamie's attorneys called, the licensed psychologist, Dr. Friedman, and that doctor said, first he talked about the particular Miranda advisement that Kreider read to Jamie, and he said it was written at a fifth or sixth grade level. He said it was impossible. He said lots of things, but he said it was impossible for somebody of Jamie's IQ and reading comprehension level to understand the advisement. This is important because that testimony was never contradicted. It was uncontradicted testimony. The prosecution put forth no witness to contradict it, and on cross-examination, I don't think they...
Because I have two related questions to that, because I understand your position that the expert testimony was uncontradicted. Now, there were extensive videotapes taken, mm-hmm. and the trial judge said he reviewed them from beginning to end and came across with the opposite conclusion that, based on his observations of the videotapes, that the defendant did understand what was going on and was capable of making informed decisions. Don't we give the trial court weight in making that observation? Don't we defer to him, essentially, or despite the fact that the expert testified
A number of the cases that I cited in the brief say, no, if it's uncontradicted, then what the court is doing is failing to take into account the totality of the circumstances. Just because he disbelieves something, it's not necessarily that this court needs to be deferential to what the trial court saw with its own eyes. He doesn't address it in his, he just says, I just used my own eyes. He ignores it. He doesn't bring it into his order. He just completely ignores it.
And my second question is, do we also have the right, as a reviewing court that can watch the exact same videotape as the trial court, to make our own determination?
I would say you have the right to consider the fact that the trial court didn't consider the uncontradicted evidence of Gianni's mental retardation and slow, low cognitive abilities. Like any other questions I'd like to reserve?
We have about 4 minutes left. Well, Mr. Martinez, I do have a question. I was concerned about the fact that the detective apparently made some false statements or gave false impressions to Jamie, which I don't think the state even argues with, that they were definitely false. The thing about the shoe and a few other things that the detective did. And it's troubling when the police do that. But can you connect up for us how it was? How did that cause him to confess? What was the sequence of events? Why do you argue that the misstatements of Detective Kreider, I guess the name was, led to the confession? Because if they don't, I think it doesn't make any difference under our law.
That is coercive conduct, which is required for to show a confession, not the waiver of the rights, but it just concerns the confession itself, whether it's voluntary or involuntary. And it's something to consider. It's coercive conduct. And it's a necessary factor, but then looking at all the factors coupled with Jamie's intelligence and so forth, it will coerce somebody who's mentally retarded.
I understand the law. What I'm asking, in the facts of this case, what was the sequence of events? Did he confess immediately after he looked at his shoe and he said,
No. In fact, throughout, even though Kreider employed all these techniques to elicit this confession, in bond reading and so forth, lying, trickery, on and on, Jamie continually maintained that he had no involvement in the homicide, so much so that every time he would do it, at least 12 times, Kreider called him a liar. It was only toward the tail end of the interrogation that Jamie finally confesses. That's the sequence. I'd like to reserve my time. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Matthew Holman, and I represent the people in this matter. I, too, will address the issues of the whether the defendant's waiver was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent, and also, to some degree, whether his mother served the proper purpose under the statute for a parent being present during the interview. I wanted to start by commenting on where Judge Richmond started, which is the court can take into account the defendant's experience with the criminal system. And I think beginning with when he's arrested, it's clear that the defendant understands a lot about the criminal justice system, in that he's already trying to offer information which he believes will be exchanged for some kind of a plea deal. And that, I think that theme carries through his interview with Detective Kreider, ultimately, where he's interested in seeing if he can obtain a plea bargain.
Correct that Kreider was called in to interview him because he said, I may have some information about a shooting or a murder that occurred, in our neighborhood. That's why Kreider was called in first place.
That's right. In the first discussion is with him as a witness and not as a potential defendant. It's only based on that and some other information that's collected that they then...
So that's what initiated the interrogation.
That's right. That's right, Your Honor. And I think throughout the interview with Detective Kreider, it's clear that the defendant, as I think it's the prosecutor said, was savvy about how the system worked and how the interview process worked. And I do think I'll start with the waiver. Reviewing the videotape of the reading of the Miranda rights, it's clear that the defendant was following those. and then he said that he understood them. Now, that was preceded by a conversation with his mother, which was off the record, so we don't obviously don't have that discussion, but there is an indication on the form that they did discuss his rights. Then, as Judge Ramon pointed out, not only does the detective ask if he understands those rights and wants to waive them, but then his mother also asks him essentially the same question to say, says, do you understand what you're doing, and do you want to talk to him? So I think that both goes to the waiver and ultimately to whether his mother is playing the proper role in the interview setting. The defendant's mental capacity is, as the cases say, one factor in the totality of the circumstances, which Mr. Martinez, I think, agrees with that standard. The one thing is that the court did essentially reject the expert's opinion about the defendant's ability to understand the rights and to waive them and understand the consequences. But that finding is based on at least two things, which is, the videotaped interviews and also the testimony of Detective Kreider. And I was thinking about your question, Judge Ramon, about can this court review this essentially a factual de novo review. I would argue no, that deference remains with the trial court. And one of the reasons is because the court also had the opportunity to hear Detective Kreider testify, and that's part of what goes into that determination. And obviously we have a transcript of that, but I think that deference still remains ultimately with the court, and absent the finding that the facts really don't support the trial court's finding that you know, this court should uphold those factual findings.
Mr. Holman, let me ask you this. Is there a point at which a defendant's mental capacity could per se be the fact that deprives the defendant of being able to knowingly and intelligently waive his rights under Miranda? I'm bothered that we do have an expert saying we have a retarded defendant here. We have an IQ level that is first grade level, and we have Miranda rights that perhaps a fifth or sixth grader could understand. When do we get to that point?
And let me address this, your first question, and then that the statement about the facts. One is, I suppose there's a point at which a defendant's mental capacity might cause him to be unable to understand and properly waive his rights. But I think in determining that, it's not simply whether an expert testifies about that. It's also, as it was done here, also watching the videotape to see whether it appears that that was a knowing, voluntary, intelligent waiver. So, in other words, I guess what I'm saying is, if his IQ still makes it him unable, as demonstrated, to understand and waive those rights, I suppose it might be the dominating factor. I think one of the problems we have here as far as the expert, and I think why the court validly rejected it, is what the expert says is he has a first or second grade reading ability, and that's different from saying that he couldn't understand when he's being told about his rights as to what they are and whether he wants to waive them. And again, we also have factors such as his experience with the justice system that seems very apparent, as I said, from the moment he's arrested throughout the interview process, that he seems very experienced and savvy as to what's going on there and clearly understands what's going on. Judge.
I'll follow up and push this a little further along the lines of where Judge Hawthorne's going. Based on the case law and the research that you've done, is there any difference in how courts treat adults with normal IQs versus juveniles with diminished mental capacity?
I don't recall seeing any case law applying different legal standards in these situations. I think there are cases that Mr. Martinez cited from other jurisdictions that use terms, and this may not be the language, heightened concern or something, but I think all those cases are saying the same thing that our cases say, which is mental capacity is one factor in whether This is a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver. And it's not the only factor. And again, going back to the expert relied on several school tests done on the defendant, tests that were not done by him, never asked him the real question, which was, did you understand what these rights meant? You know, what do you think they mean? Did you understand that by waiving this, you would be talking to the officer about the crime and that, you know, he might reveal something or he might ultimately admit something? None of those central questions were asked, and I think, like any expert in any case, the trial court is free to reject that and find simply that that opinion is not ultimately supported by the other evidence in the case, which is, I think, what happened here.
I switch gears for just a moment.
Sure.
There's a judicial bias issue out there that was not addressed, but that I have a question about.
Uh-huh.
If we conclude that judicial bias occurred here, would that be structural error that required automatic reversal?
No, Your Honor, and I'll start at the beginning, which may not be the direct answer to your question, which is this claim is waived, so we don't even reach the question of whether it would rise to the level of structural error. I think, and I feel like I'm avoiding answering your maybe central question, but the other problem with the defense argument is that there isn't any showing here whatsoever of judicial bias. The focus is on two unfavorable rulings about evidentiary matters, and those are consistently considered to be things well within the judicial prerogative and are not indicative of judicial bias. I know unfavorable rulings and even occasionally hostile responses by the court to an attorney are not automatically considered judicial bias. So I don't think we reached the level of error. If we could get past waiver and the evidentiary matter, if a judge is so biased that it could rise to the level of structural error, I still think, I was trying to remember and I didn't research, I think it's Justice Scalia who actually has indicated that even structural error claims can be waived. And I think we just stop here at the first tier.
Has the entire Supreme Court or a majority of the Supreme Court said that, Justice Scalia?
That I don't know, Your Honor. It was on my list of things to look at. I apologize. I didn't look. But one is, I don't think the facts here even meet a threshold showing of judicial bias, but certainly the requirements for affidavits and a timely motion aren't met here, and the case law consistently says such claims waived. And for good reason, because there may be an opportunity both for either the trial judge or the opposing party to explain why those rulings were perfectly fine and were not a reflection of judicial bias whatsoever. I'll just turn briefly to the question of the mother's participation in the interview. And I was trying to think of course, a snappy comparison and say that the defendant's mother doesn't have to be June Cleaver, and I thought that was out of date, so I thought, well, she doesn't have to be Mrs. Huxtable on the Cosby Show, and I looked that up, and that's 20 years out of date, so even all of my references are old, but I think the point is...
Get him.
I think the point is that she's not... As I think maybe the prosecutor or the court said, she's not obligated to act as an attorney, and while an attorney might have advised the defendant to do something different, that's certainly not the standard. As Mrs. Huxtable, by the way, was a lawyer in the TV series, and she's also not supposed to be perfect. She's allowed to be distressed in the situation, and I would say that the point where she gets up and leaves, although I'm just looking at it and judging it myself, I think it shows that she's distressed by the fact that he has admitted he's involved in this, and she needs to get up and leave. But ultimately, she comes back in the room. At the beginning where she's talking on the phone, I also think people do unusual things in stressful situations, and I can think of people in car accidents where they want to do something seemingly regular in a somewhat stressful situation, and it may seem odd, but it doesn't mean she's not there to essentially supported her son and help him make his decisions about what he wants to do. Notably, she doesn't say, please go on and interview him while I chat on the phone with my friend, you know, whatever, that's fine with me. It's happening before they really get started, as I recall. I think her statement about she doesn't want to bail him out is probably a reflection of her frustration with his obviously lengthy interaction with the justice system. But she also does ask him at the beginning, as Judge Roman pointed out, does he understand and does he want to waive his rights? And she ultimately stays there with him through the interview. I think where she's sitting is really irrelevant. I'm not sure, perhaps the officer put the chair where it was. But she may be in a better position to observe her son and have eye contact with him than if she's sitting next to him while he's talking. So she may be in a much better position, I think, to assume that it means she's aligned with the police and against her son is just not a necessary conclusion from that. I think that's all I really wanted to touch on, unless the court has any other questions. Thank you for your time.
Bailiff, would you add 1 minute? Martinez, right?
Yes, thank you.
Martinez's time, we asked quite a few questions and intruded on your rebuttal time somewhat.
Thank you. I just wanted to address a few points. First, I think it's absurd to say that Jamie is savvy. Based on this record, to say that he's savvy because he asked about a deal ignores the fact that he asked about getting a deal on outstanding warrants, and he eventually became the subject of the murder that he had the information on. That does not seem savvy to me.
Did he initiate the interrogation by saying, I want to tell you about a shooting that occurred in our neighborhood?
No, he did not.
How did it get started then? You disagree?
It started after the officer. They talked to him once. He implicated his friend Johnson. Then the officers went and interviewed Johnson. Johnson's girlfriend said that Jamie said that he did it. And then Jamie had been transferred from Denver jail to, I think, Gilliam. The officers, on a separate and distinct date, go to see Jamie. He doesn't know that he's the suspect, not until the interview is underway. So he didn't initiate that. He wanted to talk about his outstanding warrants. Also, with respect to Kreider's testimony, is something that the court could rely upon in making its determination, even though it ignored the uncontradicted evidence from the expert. That statement really, it's essentially just a conclusory statement saying, I did not violate this mentally retarded kid's rights. I hope I don't box this completely, but I'm not sure which one of you asked this question, but at what point does mental capacity equal per se unintelligent and not knowing? I'm not trying to be funny, but, you know, Mr. Holman said that it would have to be consistent with what somebody would see on a video. So if somebody said, yes, I understand my rights, yes, I waive my rights, then that apparently would be sufficient, notwithstanding how low somebody's IQ was and comprehension abilities. But, you know, a parent can say yes or no. And you could not, a parent could say yes or no, and a parent could be videotaped and they could be asked the question, do you understand your rights? And could say, yes. Do you waive your rights? Yes. And none of us in here would say, oh, then that parrot even though the parrot has an IQ of, we don't even know, it's a bird, we couldn't say that it, because the videotape of it was inconsistent with the IQ because it appeared to be acknowledging that it understood the rights and waived the rights, that it therefore didn't involuntarily, or unintelligently, I'm sorry, unknowingly waive the rights. If that makes any sense. Also, I just want to clarify this. It wasn't just, the expert didn't say that Jamie's reading ability was the only low thing. He said word comprehension ability. He focused on word comprehension ability, and he broke it up into three different parts. One was reading, one was word recognition, one was comprehension. Let's see.
Time is up, Mr. Martinez.
Thank you, Your Honors. I hope you all reverse Jamie's convictions based on the arguments in the opening brief and suppress the statement.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank both of you for your arguments. This matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.